Hello and welcome to another Extra Time podcast. Today is the Rugby World Cup special part two. My name's Steve Luckins. I'm the senior sports editor on the Sports Desk. Joining me today, I'm delighted to welcome on the phone from Dubai, Roelof Kotze, the UAE performance manager. Roelof is uniquely placed to talk about development rugby, especially. He has worked at the Natal Sharks in his native South Africa. He's also working on the development squads for the UAE team. Roelof, we understand that you're just fresh back off the plane from the China Sevens. How did the UAE perform in that tournament?
Yeah, Steve, we were quite happy with our results in the end. We had a tough day one. As we knew before, we had to play against Hong Kong, who's the second-seeded team, or the first-seeded team in Asia. And then we had to play the Philippines, who ended up fifth in last year's tournament. And we lost those two games. But we came back on the second day, and we beat Chinese Taipei in the semi-final, and Singapore in the final of the bowl. So we came away with our first victories on the Asian circuit as well as our first trophy. So we're very pleased.
I understand it was a lot of the guys' first time ever playing sevens international level.
Yeah, there were seven of our boys who played in their first international tournament. So day one was a steep learning curve, and they found that it was a little bit faster and a little bit more intense than your normal club games. But the boys adapted quite well and played very well in that too, as the result shows. And we think from here we can just go bigger and better.
Excellent. Okay, right. Let's move on to the business end of the show. Let's talk about the World Cup. Today's focus is going to be on South Africa. You obviously have a rich history of, you know, in rugby, and particularly with South Africa. Roelof, the first thing I want to ask you is, can you explain to us what the complaint was against the South Africa side that's since been thrown out? And was there ever an actual, a genuine fear there would not be a Springboks team competing at the World Cup?
Steve, yeah, the complaint, as I saw it on the news sites and things like that, is that there wasn't a big enough representation of the demographics of the country in the side. Which just comes back to the whole development and transformation actions that started 20-odd years ago when apartheid ended. And this political party seemed to be formed 24 hours before the complaint was made, or changed their name or something, came up with this complaint. It's sort of a thing that happens every so often when national sides, high-profile national sides, get selected, where new political parties try and score cheap points from voters. So I don't think it was ever really a danger of the side not making it to the World Cup. But saying that, these sort of distractions, I don't think, help in preparations for a tournament. Even if it happens every 4 years, it still makes it very hard.
It's something the team could have done without before they set off to the UK. So would you say the criticisms of the coach, Heineke Meyer, in only selecting the bare minimum of non-white players was justified?
It's always an interesting discussion, Steve, as to what is the bare minimum. Obviously, there's targets that are set out by SA Rugby for how many guys should be in every side. To say it's a bare minimum is harsh. I think in some cases there were players that were of colour, if I can call them so, that were unlucky not to get selected. But, you know, one wants to pick the best side, and the coach has to pick a side that has to run out on Saturday and perform. And sometimes guys get unlucky in selections. And what happens is then these people who count numbers to see who has been selected jump on that wagon and say, yeah, but the other guys who should have been selected. I think in a country like South Africa, for every guy that gets selected, there's probably another five that can feel unlucky. So is it a black-white thing, or is it a thing where, you know, we used to say, Heineke Meyer's side has to play on the weekend, not mine, so I can pick a very different side.
Sure. I mean, quota systems in themselves are obviously mess with every single player, really. Depending on which side of the fence you sit on, someone's going to feel left out. As a coach, your integrity is based on being honest with players. So how do you go about telling a player he hasn't made a side, or he hasn't got a contract because a player has been fast-tracked into his position because of his colour or background?
Yeah, I think as a coach, you try and avoid bringing up that as the reason for the exclusion. Now, how we tend to have worked with in the past and probably will in the future is you look at players, and if there's a clear player, call it the white player, that is clearly better than anybody else, it's a no-brainer. You get selected and gets the contracts and whatever. If it's a case of a black and white player that players that are very closely matched in skill sets, in abilities, in needs of the team and things like that, you are obliged in some ways to pick the black guy, but it wouldn't make a difference. So you really don't want to go into discussion with players and blame the system like that. You know, I don't think you would go there. It will serve no purpose for you or the player to be told this and any reason you're not.
Sorry to interrupt. I guess just to kind of bring that back to your current role in this Sevens tournament, you were able to bring back expatriate players. I know the UAE Rugby Federation made a big push for sole Emirati teams. And is that a decision you welcomed?
Yeah, it was a decision I welcomed because we were clearly lacking in some areas in our skill sets with Emirati players that we've got expat players in the country that can fulfill those roles. You know, so having those people available and then watching Sevens from the sideline makes no sense. So one has to understand that there's certain cycles in our rugby and specifically our Sevens that we go through where we've got Olympic cycles where we need to qualify for Olympic Games and so forth, where we can only use guys with Emirati passports, which is where we were last year and the year before. Trying to get as high as we can in Olympics. That cycle is now done for us. And therefore, we can now use the expats again to try and fast-track some of our Emirati players. There's no doubt that if, as a young, inexperienced player, you play against a guy who's played rugby all his life, you're going to understand a lot quicker as to what the coach wants you to do. So we believe that is where we're going with this program, is where we're using the expats to help us upskill and fast-track our Emirati players to be able to, in another 2 years' time, when the Olympic cycle comes around, stand on their own and hopefully reach qualification up to our next level as to where we were this year.
Okay, Roloff, and back to South Africa. Every year at the Sevens in Dubai, the core of the Springbok side is black. There are black players in the key decision-making positions, and that includes some of the finest seven players ever, such as Kabamba Flores, Mzwandili Stick, Seso Africa. Why has that never, or at least not yet, why has that not happened at 15s level?
I think you've got to look at, in some ways, so Africa is a country that is size-obsessed in their 15-a-side game, where the belief is that a good big one will always beat a good small one. Whereas in sevens, size is not the be-all and end-all. It's far more of a quicker skill set, and in some cases, size does not help you. So, and what you will find is that back home, most of the black players, and trust me, there are some really quality, good, big black players that are coming through the system. It will just take them a while. And as I said, you know, there's a lot of them that are unlucky, but so there's a lot of other players that are unlucky. But I think it will take time to get the necessary skill sets and or to change the minds of the South African rugby public, not just the coaches, the whole rugby public, that size is not the only skill set that we need. And once that shift happens, things will change.
Roloff, that's great. And just very quickly, predictions for the World Cup, how will South Africa do?
As a loyal and born and bred South African Springbok supporter, I would have to say I think we could get quite as far, I would say, as the semis, if things go our way. We haven't had a great preparation. We've got a lot of injuries. So I think semi-final is realistic. It's going to be tough to beat New Zealand and Ireland. So those will be my two sort of guys that I see happening in the final. I haven't looked at the locks that closely whether that's a possibility. But for South Africa to get to the final, that will take a real special effort from a lot of guys. And I don't know that we've had the preparation run up to this World Cup that will get us there.
Okay, excellent. Roloff, it's been a pleasure talking to you. All the best for your future endeavours with the UAE team, and hopefully we'll have you back on Extra Time Podcast soon.
So thanks, Steve. Yeah, hopefully we can have another chat at some stage.
Look forward to it. All the best.
Thanks, Andy. Cheers.
So Roelof Kotse there, the UAE performance manager. Well, thankfully for me and for all of you, he's not our only guest today. Back with me is Paul Radley, our man who knows everything about rugby in the UAE and across the world. Let's see if he can name drop a few more names into today's discussion. I'm sure he's met pretty much everyone we're about to talk about. Paul, I want to talk to you about the warm-up games on the weekend. We've already had some injury withdrawals from the World Cup before it's even begun. Lee Halfpenny and Rhys Webb will not compete. That is a massive blow for Wales.
Massive, yeah, probably an understatement, actually. Lee Halfpenny, probably the world's best goal kicker, and Rhys Webb, the player of the year for Wales last year. Obviously, Warren Gatland's suffered a lot of criticism for fielding both of them, and certainly Halfpenny.
I mean, you could see how heavily strapped Halfpenny's knee was before the game. And, you know, every rugby player pretty much will tell you that they play games 80%, 90% fit, but it just seemed like such a meaningless game to risk him in.
Yeah, Gatland's tried to explain it away by saying that a lot of the play, if he'd have wrapped everybody in cotton wool, then they'd only have had one game since the end of last season before they faced, you know, the business matches basically in their pool. But yeah, like you said, just looking at him, it looked like he'd been stuck together with band-aids basically. But even that Gatland explained away as it being sort of like a comfort thing for him because he'd been. He'd had discomfort or injuries that he was wanting to nurse through, and he'd worn the strapping the whole time while he was you know coming back from that, and it just felt comfortable for him, so he carried on playing. So his thinking was that it looked worse than it actually was, and that the injury would have occurred anyway. But I suppose we'll never know.
Okay, yeah, and obviously Rhys Webb, as you said, Wales Player of the Year, is a massive blow, but. What a replacement to call up, eh? A guy with 99 test caps to his name, Mike Phillips.
Yeah, I think most of us were amazed that he got cut so early from the squad at all. Obviously, he's got a wealth of experience, like you said, all those caps for Wales and a British and Irish Lions winner as well. So presumably, there was a reason that Gatland dropped him in the first instance. But yeah, like you say, it's a pretty good replacement to bring in after that injury.
We all know Gatland's, you know, he's a master tactician, but he's full of left field decisions as well. It wouldn't surprise me if Phillips went from not being in the World Cup squad to going into the first game as first choice.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think he did something similar during the Lions, he rested him, I think, in the middle game to nurse through an injury. But I'm pretty sure Gatland will have full trust in Mike Phillips as and when he needs him.
And let's talk about England's performance against Ireland. What was your analysis of that?
Oh, it's very positive for England because, bearing in mind the standard of the opposition, yep. Ireland were going in. I think Roloff in his interview just then actually
he's picked them to make the final.
Yeah, yeah. New Zealand Ireland final from Roloff, and he knows everything there is to know about it. So that just goes to show.
Are you saying he knows more than you, Radders? God, we'll have to get him on the show more regularly.
Yeah, we will, yeah.
I think what most impressed me, or what was more reassuring to see, was Mike Brown under the high ball. That guy is Mr. Reliable.
Yeah, because they went for it, didn't they, the Irish? I think that was definitely a tactical ploy that they thought that certainly that I think a lot of teams might be targeting the two England wingers more than Mike Brown himself. Johnny May and Anthony Watson aren't necessarily fully confirmed as being secure under the high ball, so it might be a tactic that is often used against England in the World Cup, but if it's going anywhere near Mike Brown, you think he looks safe as houses.
Well, that's all we've got time for today. Some great guests on the show today. I can't believe someone eclipsed Paul Radley. Paul, thank you for joining me. Roelof Kotse, UAE performance manager, with some great insight there. We'll definitely have him back on the show. Radders, thanks for joining us, mate. It's been lovely speaking to you.
Yeah, good to be here again. Thanks, Steve.
This podcast was recorded by Deepti Unnikrishnan on the multimedia desk at The National. You can follow them on Twitter at NSVUAE. Follow us on the sports desk at NatSportUAE. Or for more Rugby World Cup stories, go to the website thenational.ae/sport.